So you want to operate a Part 141 flight school and write your own curriculum. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest, as is the case most Mondays, is Bob Miller. Bob puts out Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot. You can read that on the internet at overtheairwaves.com. Bob also has recently opened the Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated Flight School based at the Buffalo Lancaster Airport. And we're going to talk a little bit about the monster that that has become today. Bob, thanks for taking some time out to join us.
Well, as always, Paul, it's my pleasure to talk with you.
I'm a little surprised you have some time to take out to join us. From all accounts, you've lit the fuse on something bigger than you thought.
Well, I did. As you know, I opened a flight school back in December, and it has been growing steadily. And one of the reasons for doing this was to conduct a grand experiment that confirmed or refuted many of the things that I had been talking about in Over the Airwaves regarding the state of flight instruction and various ways that we can make it better. And rather than being just simply a critic of the existing system, I felt it would be kind of an interesting experience to go ahead and practice what I preached. And that resulted in the formation of the flying school or the flight school.
Well, Bob, and now let me interrupt you right there, because what you have preached has largely been critical of the status quo at most Part 141 flight schools. You started out Part 61. Now I hear you've turned in your papers to go Part 141.
Well, exactly, and I think it's in an effort to remain intellectually honest with myself and my readers. My opponents are the folks that haven't agreed with me on my take on the Part 141 schools and the criticism I've had with the traditional way much of the flight training is conducted there, said, you know, in friendly terms, Bob, you're operating under Part 61, which, as you know, gives us a great deal of freedom. It's not nearly as regulated as a Part 141 approved flight school. And I found my critics to be correct. I could do things on my own without FAA oversight, and I had a great deal of freedom. And I thought, well, listen, let's be truly honest and see if we could make it work under the Part 141 structure. That is, could I, under that structure, affect some changes that would result in some of the improvements that I had been talking about. In other words, I wanted to get onto the same level playing field, so to speak, as the other Part 141 schools, just to keep it, comparing apples to apples, if you will.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you have been a proponent of and how they fit into the Part 141 world, because I find this interesting. Some of the more advanced flight training you do with instrument students, for example, your mountain flying, your trips into the major New York airports to get people used to that regimen, how are those things going to be affected, or can you still conduct things with freedom as long as your school is not calling it primary instruction?
Well, yes, you've touched upon the major difference. All curriculum under the Part 141 environment must be approved by the FAA. If we're going to operate a private pilot or conduct a private pilot course or an instrument pilot course or commercial, the curriculum used must be approved, and much of that curriculum in use today is a prepackaged curriculum put out by major publishers of curriculum, such as Jeppesen or Gleim, and it's easy to get those rather traditional curricula approved. And I maintain all along that one could operate with an approved FAA curriculum, but still at the same time modify it in such a way as to make flight training, the conduct of flight training, much more efficient, much more interesting, much more enjoyable to the student, and do it within the constraints of the Part 141 system simply by providing that training as an additional add-on to the curriculum, or better yet, having the FAA come in and approve the revised curriculum.
Well, now, have you come up with a revised curriculum that the FAA is going to get a look at?
In process. That curriculum is in process, and as anybody who has gone through the 141 certification process knows, that this is not an overnight effort. It's going to be 6 months, perhaps, or more to bring the whole process to a completion so that my school can receive the Part 141 certificate. But what I am doing now is changing what curriculum that I have been using with the intent of bringing it to the FAA for their ultimate blessing. Let me just give you an example of
Sure.
the difference. We have a major problem in general aviation. It's a pretty well-known fact that close to 60% of all students who receive a medical, a student pilot certificate, close to 60% never make it to check ride.
Mm-hmm.
They drop out for one reason or another. And while we lament the constant declining of the total population, we in the flight training community and leaders within the general aviation industry seem to look another way when over 50,000 new pilots quit before they receive their private pilot certificate.
Mm-hmm.
50,000 pilots a year. Why are they leaving? Why do they find it necessary to drop out of training when they had enough enthusiasm to sign up and at least obtain a private a student pilot certificate? I think much of the problem has to do with the traditional curriculum. If you look at the primary pilot curriculum that's published by folks like Jeppesen and Gleim and a number of others, you'll see that the first one, two, three, or four lessons are basically basic attitude flying. We go up, we learn to do constant speed climbs, descents, turns. We learn to do ultimately steep turns. We go to turns over a point. And through that exercise, or those exercises, we manage to drive the joy of flying out of the hearts of many of those new pilot startups. By changing the curriculum to take the cross-country portion of the curriculum that is typically at the end of the private pilot training course and push it up front, we have an opportunity for the student to experience cross-country flight, which is really the most enjoyable. I think most listeners would agree that a day of cross-country flying is much more interesting than a day of air work in the practice area.
Mm-hmm.
So by modifying the curriculum to do that, we can still achieve many of the same airmanship skills that we would obtain in the practice area, but we can do it on long cross-country flights to places that the student himself or herself chooses. It may be a sister's house in a city 150 miles away, or it may be a major city where they would like to stop, run into town and do something entertaining and come back. And you're really working the first half of the curriculum, I call it an art of seduction, in a way that we take a student who starts up excited about aviation and enhance that excitement by showing them firsthand what the ultimate utility of the aircraft is, and by seducing them into the national airspace system, their enthusiasm begins to build rather than, oh, why am I doing this? This is frustrating. I have enough stresses at work. Why do I need to add this to my daily life, you know, when I come out to the airport on Saturday and then have a flight instructor start beating this into me? And I think that's largely the reason why we're losing. Now, 60%, Paul, that's not an insignificant number when you look at the total number of private pilots, student pilots at any one time.
No, you know, if you looked into any kind of business proposition and told someone that your plan was to have 60% of your recruiting budget, time, and effort go down the drain, they'd look at you and say, well, why are you doing it that way?
We've been doing it this way, as far as I can tell, for nearly 65 years. We still have the same 40-hour curriculum. It still follows the same tried and true, let's go out to the practice area, let's go through these ritualistic exercises. That worked in the military. That worked in the Second World War when we needed to get pilots trained quickly. They were motivated. They wanted to be military pilots. But in the recreational environment that we work and live in today, where there's so many competing ways to spend our recreational dollars and our recreational time, we don't want to go out and be stressed with mindless exercises by well-intentioned flight schools without understanding that we're just really driving our customers right out the door.
Bob, when we come back from the break, I have a couple of questions as regards how you fit this practically within making sure students do things like learn how to land. We'll talk about that in a moment. Bob Miller is my guest. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller, and we're talking about flight training and Bob's walking the plank, so to speak, into the Part 141 world with some of the ideas which have in the past challenged Part 141 status quo. Bob, you've talked about moving cross-country training up to the front of the syllabus. Practically speaking, if you're going to solo someone or if they're going to pass their check ride or even bring back a rented plane safely, at some point you do need to do some repetition of landings and takeoffs. How do you do that?
That comes later on in the curriculum after we have really planted the seed of enthusiasm in the student's mind. Just think about the mindset that any of us or our listeners went through when we learned how to fly. Basically, many of us went out to the aerodrome. We weren't really sure what private pilot flying was all about. We thought we would give it a try and see if we like it. Well, in the process of giving it a try and seeing if we like it, this is when the mindless exercises were put in place. We had lessons 1, 2, and 3. We went through these drills. And that's where we lost them. Now, by putting the maneuvering skills towards the end of the curriculum, by that time, we have used, and it's a rather colorful term, we have really, by that time, seduced them into the notion that flying is really a wonderful experience. I've experienced the joys of being at the controls. I know what this is all about. Now, being fully committed, now I'm ready to go through some of the more painful exercises of repetitious landings and doing the maneuvering and performing the maneuvering skills or learning the maneuvering skills that we need to do it. But we've done it after we've sold the sizzle. Mm-hmm. And that's just like going into a fine restaurant, and rather than the ambience is important. The courtesy of the waiters is important. We really kind of bring the customer to a point of, gee, I am really happy I am here. Right. And then at that point, if the meat's a little cold or the chicken's a little underdone, at least we know we've got the customer interested. And they're much more willing to be tolerant of some of our imperfections, if you will.
Well, let me ask you the final question, and that is how this meshes with your goal of conducting primary and instrument training together. Is this going to be part of your syllabus as you submit it?
Yes, it is. It will be. And as I'm filing the Part 141 certificate, I'm also completing a contractual relation with the relationship with the Cessna folks to develop or turn the flight school into a Cessna pilot center. And that's a whole other set of activities. But in doing that, Cessna brings to the table their curriculum that they've developed, and they're already working on a combined private instrument integrated curriculum, 100 lesson type of curriculum. So that will be canned and ready to use, hopefully, by the time I'm set up or completed with the Part 141. As soon as we get the curriculum, we're going to go ahead and adopt it. But even without that pre-written or canned curriculum, we can still do it. For example, just to give you a good example, on those instrument flights on the cross-country flights for private pilots, in the G1000 cockpit, there is an overwhelming amount of information. And mm-hmm. when asking an individual low-time student to just simply follow a heading, maintain altitude and airspeed with the distractions of looking out the window, this is an ideal time to put them under a view-limiting device. And using the view-limiting device, much like blinders on a horse, so that the student will just simply focus on that part of the G1000 glass panel that really gives them the information they need. Well, in the process, Paul, the student truly masters this idea of trimming the airplane, maintaining heading plus or minus 5 degrees, maintaining altitude plus or minus 40 feet mm-hmm. rather than the 200 feet allowed for in the practical test standards. In the process of doing that, they're developing instrument scanning skills at the primary level. It's a little bit like teaching elementary students, primary school students in grades 2 and 3, teaching a foreign language at that level, rather than waiting till the individual is in high school and then attempting to teach a foreign language. In traditional K-12 education, they're finding that this is a much more beneficial point in the learning process down in grades 1, 2, and 3 to begin some of this foreign language. Same thing happens with the instrument training. Lastly, let me make the point that, again, this is a little easier with a glass cockpit or even with any kind of a multifunction display where you're having a moving map. A student with barely 6-7 hours total time in the airplane, when you turn them on to an instrument approach like an ILS, it becomes really for them a walk in the park. We say simply just follow the lines, follow the arrows, follow the heading instructions by ATC. And again, this is being done very early in the stages of the private pilot curriculum. So now, equivalent to grades 1st, 2nd, or 3rd grade in public school, they're learning the fine art of setting up for instrument approaches. A lot of work has been done on this. Mid-Tennessee University, I know Embry-Riddle's been involved in this. Jeppesen has been involved in this in terms of integrating the training. The trick I have now, or not the trick, the objective is, it would be easy to do this under Part 61 because the flight instructor is not regulated. But if we can get it through the FAA under the Part 141 framework, then I can go out and say, hey, listen, I will not accept the fact that just because we're under 61, we can do things that can't be done under 141. I'd like to prove out in this grand experiment of mine that even under Parts 141, we can effectively change the way students are taught how to fly.
Well, Bob, you've got a lot of other people thinking the same way you are. I know the folks at Cirrus are big, big proponents of combining instrument training in with primary training, and I think the logic is perfectly sound. We want to keep up on how you do with this because this is a grand experiment, as you call it. We want to see how this works out.
We've got to do something about the 60% dropout rate. I mean, that's, again, doing the numbers, that's 50,000 lost pilots a year. And we're spending, as you indicated, a lot of time and money recruiting in Be a Pilot programs and Young Eagle programs, but they're coming in the front door. They're just flowing out the back door.
We will keep in touch and have a great week.
Thank you. You too, Paul.
If you have any comments on what Bob and I talked about today, please drop me an email and let me know. My email address is paulp, that's P-A-U-L-P, at aero-news.net. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.